This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been a period of both rejection and success for Amy Mann, a singer-songwriter who was recently described in Rolling Stone as pop's wryest documentarian of love's emotional roller coaster. Let's start with one example of her success, her Academy Award-nominated song Save Me from the 1999 film Magnolia.
You
Amy Mann not only wrote most of the songs for the film Magnolia, the movie was inspired by one of her songs. Nevertheless, she had to bring out her new CD, Bachelor No. 2, on her own record label. The label she had been recording for merged with another label. After the merger, her new CD wasn't considered commercial enough to release. After buying back her master tape from her record company, she planned to release it only on the internet. But with the success of her Magnolia soundtrack, she's also gotten the new CD into stores. The opening track is a song about being misled by a lover or maybe a record company.
I can't do it, I can't conceive. You're everything you're trying to make me believe. Cause this show is too well designed to want to be held with only me.
Amy Mann, welcome to Fresh Air. Well, you decided to put your CD Bachelor No. 2 out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been using, it's available in stores now, but it was initially, I think, only supposed to be available on the internet. Am I right about that?
It was initially offered on the internet, and I sold it at my shows,
mm-hmm.
mainly because, you know, I mean, that's very contrary to, you know, to the sort of traditional record company protocol, where you sort of you have a release date and it's released in all formats, and you know you come out with a big splash. But you know, I sort of felt like it had been a long time since I had a record out, and you know that I mean this record has been done for, you know, it's basically finished about a year and a half ago. So I just wanted to get it out to my fans as soon as possible. And, you know, and anybody who was interested in searching for it on the internet or anyone who came to a show, I wanted to have that available to them. And, you know, I just thought, well, you know, I'll deal with the rest of it as it comes along.
Now, how did you use the internet, and how much of your music were you offering for free, and how much of it was sales only?
Well, I try to be very circumspect about that. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody's crazy about giving their music away. I think the idea of sort of free downloads or, you know, that kind of thing is, for an artist like me, is especially difficult because it's harder to find my music in really traditional outlets. You know, I mean, it's you're not going to go to Tower and see the big giant display, you know, with a big pile of records and, you know, and be constantly reminded and hear it on the radio. You know, it's not as accessible because there's not the, you know, a large record company presence behind it. So, you know, it's, I think for music like mine, I mean, the internet is sort of where you go to first. And you know, that sort of free download thing kind of really cuts into somebody, you know, cuts into the sales pretty significantly. And, you know, and since I have to finance my own record and I have to finance everything having to do with the record, it's, that can get pretty tricky. I mean, we did some limited, you know, streaming audio and download stuff, but it's kind of hard to know what, you know, if you're promoting yourself or cutting your own throat, really.
Right, when you're giving stuff away for free on the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm sure you've seen this as part of Newsweek's June 5th cover story about Napster. There's an illustration headlined, How Napster Nabs Tunes, and the tune being downloaded in this illustration is your song, Save Me. The implication is that you'd become something of, like, the queen of the internet.
Well, I don't know what to think about that. I mean, I don't, you know, they wanted me to give a quote for that story, and I still don't really know what to think about it, because I think on the one hand, you know, something like Napster is helpful so people can hear the music before they buy it. But then again, if they don't have to buy it, then they can hear it before they just take it. And you know, I think people have to understand that it's not like the kids against the suits. It's the kids against the artists, you know. I mean, look, are a couple of free downloads going to hurt Britney Spears' business? You know, probably not. But I mean, but that could be all the business that I would get, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, how successful have you been on the internet in actually selling your records or using it to promote them or, you know, make people aware of your music?
Well, we've used it. It's kind of random, really. You know, I mean, there's not like really a plan. I think that things come up and it sounds like a good idea. You know, you do some sort of, you know, chats and you know, online chats and you know, a couple of downloads here and there and interviews and online magazines and that kind of thing. And just, you know, and it does kind of accumulate into something. I mean, certainly having the record available for sale on the internet was a really a great thing. I mean, that really kind of jump started stuff for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially because it's only been recently that I signed a distribution deal to get the records into stores, and you know, it's in stores now, but for a long time it wasn't. So yeah, I think it's just helpful to have a place for, you know, sort of diehard fans, you know, people who really care about it to find out where you are.
Nick Hornby, who wrote the novel High Fidelity that the movie was adapted from, has an article about you in The New Yorker, and he wrote, "What have things come to when the ability to purchase a CD over the counter by one of America's sparkiest musical talents is a cause for celebration?" I mean, he was like shocked, like, "Oh, we have to celebrate. It should be a big deal that your CD is in a store. That should be obvious."
I know, I'm telling you. Well, but that's, you know, that's the way things are now. You know, that's, I mean, I feel like I've been, you know, that's a real sign of success, you know, that I'm able to get my record into stores. But, you know, I mean, it's you know, the major labels, I mean, have pretty much a monopoly, and that's the way it's been. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of new, I think there's a lot of people who are in my position who are either disgusted with the major label system or have been, you know, kind of squeezed out of the major label system or, you know, ostracized from it or disenfranchised or whatever, and will kind of go the route that I'm going. I mean, I was kind of forced into it. It was never my dream to start a record label, but, you know, I had to get to the point where it was just, you know, it was just unworkable, you know. I mean, it just didn't work for me. So, you know, it was like, well, anything's better than that. And, I mean, it's actually been kind of fun, you know. You sort of learn as you go along and figure stuff out. But mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, I have my record in stores, and it's like, you know, like pop the champagne. It's like, you know, I've hit the big time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Mann, and she has a new CD called Bachelor Number 2. Now, some of the songs on the new CD were also included on the soundtrack from the film Magnolia. You wrote all the songs for Magnolia. Paul Thomas Anderson, in his introduction to the book of the screenplay, said this. He said, "I write to music, so I better own up to stealing quite a many lines from Amy Mann, who provides all the songs in the film. The first line of Amy Mann's song, Deathly, goes something like this. Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again? This may sound familiar. You can find it somewhere in the final 30 pages of this script. I heard that line and wrote backwards. This, quote, original screenplay could, for all intents and purposes, be called an adaptation of Amy Mann's songs." So before we talk about this, let's hear the opening of that song, Deathly, that has the line that sparked the film Magnolia.
Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing each other again. 'Cause I
Amy Mann from her CD Bachelor Number 2. And that opening line, now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again, is used in the film when the young woman who's been playing her stereo too loud starts dating the cop played by John C. Reilly. Later on, after they've had a date, that's what she says to him. Amy Mann, how did you write that line in the song?
That's kind of what it was, was in my mind. I mean, I was...
It's a strange thing to think of to say to somebody.
Well, I don't think I ever said it, you know. I mean, one of the things about writing songs is you say, you know, you're able to say things that you can't say, you know. I mean, it is a strange thing to say to somebody, but, I mean, I don't know if it's that strange to feel, you know, that's... When I wrote it, I think I had sort of a big crush on somebody, and it's just sort of like, sometimes it's just like too much to take, you know, it's like too much that, you know, like, oh, don't be nice to me because then I'll really like you, and I just don't want to be, I can't take it right now. So that's sort of the place I was in. I mean, and it's also at the one in the same time about somebody that I was seeing. From their point, you know, from their viewpoint about me, because it was like he was sort of in the same kind of situation.
So how did Paul Thomas Anderson, who made Magnolia, first hear that song?
Well, he was good friends with my husband, who he had asked to do the score for his first movie, Hard Eight, and the score for Boogie Nights. So they were pretty close.
Your husband being Michael Penn.
Michael Penn, yeah. And Paul and I had gotten to be friends also. And, you know, Paul really is a big music fan. He's a big fan of Michael's. And he was, when I started going into the studio, he was very interested in what I was working on and, you know, came by the studio several times. So, you know, so he was kind of in on the music I was recording pretty much right as I was doing. And I think... he got a tape of some songs as they were being finished and was listening to them while he was writing. I think it, you know, it just obviously kind of got in his head in a certain way, or sort of put him in a particular place, you know, so he could write.
My guest is singer-songwriter Amy Mann. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Amy Mann is my guest. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. So many of your songs are about relationship troubles. Now you're married to Michael Penn, who's also a singer-songwriter. I assume you have a pretty decent relationship.
Yeah.
How is it affecting your songwriting to be in a good relationship when so many of your songs have been about bad relationships?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, the idea of writing about relationships, I mean... I don't really know what else there is. You know, I mean, to me, everything is in terms of relationships. So that's just how I look at it. You know, like even if, you know, you're sort of writing about your car, I mean, it's like how you feel about the car and what the car symbolizes to you and, you know, what meaning the car has for you and how you enjoy your car. You know, so it's, you know, to me, that's a relationship. So that's kind of how I look at it, you know, and I like to write songs that have a couple of levels where you can... You know, it's just like I sort of write about like a specific dynamics, and it can be applied to, you know, to whatever. I mean, if I, you know, if I'm sort of in struggles with a record company, I mean, you know, that's my, that's where I make my livelihood, and it's, you know, not surprising that, you know, that problems would come up. I mean, you know, everybody who has a boss always has trouble. You know, there's always trouble at work or trouble with a boss or some coworker or something. I mean, to me, that just seems like really, it's like really common themes. And, you know, so to me, I don't know. That's like what's interesting in life, or, you know, how you feel, you know, like people dealing with each other in various ways, and like the sort of different dynamics, and, you know, where people like come head to head, like what is that about, and how does that happen, and how can you get out of it, and, you know, can it be solved, you know, can people's differences be mediated? You know, I just think that's all really interesting.
I was wondering, though, if it's easier to write from a craft point of view about bad relationships than about good ones.
I don't really write so much about good relationships or positive relationships or happy relationships that are working well, because I don't spend a lot of time thinking about why they work well. I think I already, you know, I know what makes a good relationship and what makes a relationship work well, and it's not sort of like something that I ponder. Do you know what I mean? Like when I write a song, it's because I'm pondering some, you know, some sort of question, or, you know, something that really absorbs me, or, you know, or maybe it's a, you know, a problem or a difficulty that I'm trying to figure out. But like a good relationship, you don't, you know, or a happy circumstance, I mean, you don't figure it out. There's sort of nothing to figure out. You just have it. You know, you just have it and enjoy it.
You and Michael Penn recently toured together. And the articles about the tour reported that you were both to actually talk between songs. So you had comics doing the banter between songs instead of doing it yourself. What were you, to what, to do it yourself?
Well, I don't know what to what. I mean, I think it's just an idea we had. Michael and I had started playing shows together by playing at a place called Cafe Largo that's owned by a friend of ours. And Largo is very small, and it has a lot of acoustic acts. And the people that go there are sort of very dedicated music lovers who are kind of up for anything. So it's, you know, we could go there and play new songs, or, you know, if you played half a song that you were working on, you know, people were just kind of interested in that, and it was very sort of loose, and you didn't have to be really professional. So we had played a handful of shows, and then we were talking one night about how, you know, I think we were dissecting a show and saying, you know, like, well, that was a great show, but I just felt like such an idiot. I didn't know what to say to people. And, you know, both of us sort of have that problem where you don't often know what do you say to an audience, or, you know, sometimes you do, but it's really, you know, I mean, you can't like rehearse something. And so we both felt sort of awkward. And then we just got the idea, like, well, let's get one of our comedian friends to do the, you know, sort of banter for us between songs. And, you know, he could just come on and speak for, you know, pretend he's us and speak for us. You know, I mean, I'm sure he could do it much better than we could. So just as a lark, we started doing that. It was just really, really funny. I mean, it's such a goofy idea, but it turned out to be so funny that we really wanted to keep it in. And then eventually, you know, we just thought, you know, well, we should go on the road. We should take the show on the road.
Your songs are pretty moody. Does it break the mood to have a comic talk in between the songs?
I think it's great. I mean, it's certainly great for us. I think it serves a couple of functions. I mean, first of all, it's very entertaining for us. So it keeps it interesting for us, and it kind of serves like as a, you know, I think that sometimes that our perceived seriousness is sort of off-putting for people. And when they see the comedians and how we sort of interact with the comedians, you know, plus it takes the pressure off us. So, I mean, we do talk quite a bit, you know, and it makes it easier for us to talk. But, you know, when people see that it's really kind of a lighthearted thing, that I think that they have a deeper understanding of the songs. You know, I mean, my songs might be seen as serious and kind of angry, but I mean a lot of times I sort of mean them, you know, lines that people think are really like bitter. I mean to be just kind of sarcastic or funny even, and you know, I think that having the comedian around sort of helps to bring that out a little more. And it also, like, I find that people really focus, you know, if you're focusing on on a comic who, you know, if you're focusing on his words, that you retain that sort of focus when the music starts, so you really listen to the lyrics. And then it just becomes a more involved and thus enjoyable experience.
Amy Mann will be back in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer-songwriter Amy Mann. She wrote and performed most of the songs for the 1999 film Magnolia. Her song Save Me was nominated for an Academy Award. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. You write so much about relationships. I want to ask you about a relationship in your life. I was reading that when you were young, I guess when you were like 3 or 4 or something, your parents divorced. And then shortly after that, you were living with your father, and your mother and her new boyfriend took you, unbeknownst to your father, and moved with you to Europe. And your father searched for you with a private detective for a year. Were you aware of what was going on behind the scenes at the time?
No, I don't think you're ever aware. You know, when you're that young, you're just kind of like, you just don't question it. I mean, you know, so you're not at home, you're in planes, you're, you know, things are happening, you don't, you know, you might not like it, but I just don't think you're a kid. I mean, you just kind of go along and you know, whatever happens, I mean, that's, you know, that's what's normal because that's what's happening to you.
How old were you when you moved to Europe with your mother?
I think I was 3. I mean, I wouldn't even call it, you know, I don't know if they sort of traveled around or what, you know, what the deal is. And I mean, I'm a little, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the details are. I mean, I think the sort of basic thing was that, you know, I went away and my father didn't know where I was. And, you know, it's sort of one of those divorce situations that, you know, that are pretty common where, you know, just, I don't know, it's kind of a, just becomes a kind of a mess. You know, I mean, I grew up with my father, but I'm on pretty good terms with my mother now. So for that reason, I don't really like to talk about it a lot because, you know, I don't see any point in having her feel like, you know, really weird about it. Plus, I don't sort of know what the details are exactly. So, you know, I don't want anybody to kind of like feel, you know,
I understand.
About stuff.
I'm just wondering, though, if it affected your sense of what marriage or relationships were like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it affects it. You know, you don't really realize it's affecting it for, you know, for a long time. I mean, yeah, it's you know, I mean, I had like a real, I could sort of call it like a bad attitude. You know, like I had a real bad attitude about marriage and what marriage was. And you know, I think that there's like a whole host of assumptions, like kind of unconscious assumptions you make about relationships, you know, based on your own experiences. And, you know, I think probably one of mine that, you know, I kind of realized later was that, you know, I just had the assumption that relationships were all like, you know, they were all impermanent, you know, that they would all come to an end. And, you know, that's kind of what you're left with.
How did you decide to get married, given the cynical attitude you had about marriage?
Well, I don't really, you know, it's not like a cynical attitude so much as,
skeptical?
You know, like, no, it's like it's dysfunction, you know, I mean, I put it squarely and, you know, it's not like a posture. I mean, I think you sort of realize that you have these beliefs that you don't really know that you have. And, you know, I mean, you know, you go to therapy and you figure it out. I mean, I'm a big believer in that. I think, you know, there's like a whole, I don't know, I'm getting extremely inarticulate right now.
Well, therapy, though, is that good for songwriting? You know, to have somebody helping you introspect about your life, pointing things out, was that useful in discovering things for, say, characters to say in a song? Or
I don't know if I put it to use in that way. I just think it's to become more self-aware, to figure stuff out. Personally, I think it's fascinating. I think it's really fun. It's really interesting, and it totally goes along with my interest in, you know, relationships between people and how they interact with each other and, you know, the crazy stuff they get up to. I mean, I just think it's totally fascinating. So it's, you know, so I really love going to therapy and you know, I think it's been, you know, invaluable, absolutely invaluable. I mean, that there's sort of a, a tool out there to help people figure out stuff that heretofore you have assumed that was you couldn't figure out, you know, I mean, or that you just assume that something's just wrong with you, you know, that's just the way you are. So, yeah, I think it's a miracle, you know. I recommend it highly to everyone.
In the 80s, you were in the group Till Tuesday, which had a couple of gold records. How would you describe Till Tuesday?
You know, like a real, typical 80s band. You know, we were like the perfect 80s band. You know, it was really like a perfect grouping of people. You know, it was like the perfect confection for that time.
What was 80s about it?
Well, from my point of view, I had come out of I'd been in this band that was a three-piece band that was kind of like an art noise new wave, and you know, we sort of had this ethic of you know, you could never do anything that anybody had ever done before. You know, so if it was, you know, if there was like a chord change, or you know, if it was melodic anyway, you know, like the chord changes all had to be like very disjointed and dissonant, and you know, you couldn't sort of just lay down like a, you know, like a groove on the drums, you know, where it played 2 and 4. I mean, you couldn't do that, you know. So you couldn't. We had this rule one time where, you know, you couldn't use any cymbals, you know. It was these sort of like arbitrary rules, you know. We were so desperate to sort of be different, you know, and it was fairly unlistenable. but you know, I mean, really interesting, you know, very creative, and but after a certain time, I sort of started to feel like, you know, well, there's like a certain tyranny here, you know, and also like the lyric writing and the subject matter had to be, you know, arcane in the extreme. And I remember one, you know, a band that we were friends with, they had a song where the lyrics were a recipe for shrimp flambé, you know, so it's like, see, you know, you can't sort of have lyrics that mean anything, or, you know, love songs are right out. And, you know, I started to feel like, you know, that was like the tyranny of the, you know, of the punk movement where, you know, where it was, you know, you'd be really rebellious to write, you know, sort of a melodic love song. And so Till Tuesday for me was like a real rebellion against that. And, you know, and that's how that started for me.
Why don't you choose a song from Till Tuesday to play?
Oh, God. Well, I sort of consider that Till Tuesday, you know, the group Till Tuesday really only existed for one album, you know, for the first record. And, you know, and I would say that Voices Carry is probably the best song on that
record. That was
record.
Your hit.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear it?
Okay.
That's Amy Mann, recorded in the 80s with the group Till Tuesday. What was your stage persona like when you were with Till Tuesday compared to what it's like now when you're performing on your own?
Well, I'd say in those days, you know, you try to do what you think you're supposed to do. You know, I never felt very comfortable. I don't think I talked between songs at all. I remember the managers we had saying, you know, trying to get, you know, I mean, I'll just say right now that you know, that they were really in no position to sort of offer like advice on aesthetics in any way. But I remember them, you know, saying, giving me sort of a list of things that they thought I should do. And you know, saying that I should talk more, and they had sort of a list of things I should say, you know, which is sort of like, you know, this looks as a good looking crowd tonight, and you guys ready to rock, you know, stuff like that. And I mean, I couldn't bring myself to say that. I mean, I had like a real distaste for like, you know, real rock cliches, you know, like performance rock cliches, uh-huh. having sort of come out of the punk world, you know, like I just thought that stuff was embarrassing. So, plus I just had, you know, I mean, I just don't have an affinity for that. I mean, I'm not sort of a natural leader who can kind of get people all, you know, clapping together or whatever.
Sometimes so, that stuff really strikes me as like the rock version of Simon Says.
Absolutely. I know. It's funny. Yeah, it's kids' games. But, you know, so I never really knew what to do. And I mean, I worried about it. I think at one point, you know, it was suggested that we sort of do dance steps and, you know, because that kind of stuff was really going on. And, you know, I think we probably flirted with some dance, trying to dance on stage a little bit. And God, I just felt like really uncomfortable. I mean, it was really uncomfortable the whole way. And I don't think that I felt comfortable on stage really until, you know, truly comfortable on stage, really until I started playing Largo and just played, you know, by myself with acoustic guitar. And that's sort of the only thing that really felt like it made sense to me.
And is that what you're doing now in your performances?
Yeah, pretty much.
Acoustic guitar?
Yeah, I mean, we have a band that, you know, we sort of add people in for various things, but we call it acoustic vaudeville. So, you know, at least half of the set is, you know, we're always playing acoustic guitar, but we sort of add, you know, various instruments in, and it gets bigger, it gets smaller, but, you know, but that's always the core of it. It's just us and our guitars.
My guest is singer-songwriter Amy Mann. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Amy Mann. She wrote and performed most of the songs for the 1999 film Magnolia. Her new CD is called Bachelor Number 2. So without being too reductionist, there have been a couple of opposite phases in your music life, one being in a hit pop band and feeling uncomfortable with some of the things you were expected to do on stage, and the other feeling quite comfortable doing your own songs, but also being deemed not commercially viable at the
right.
same time. Although I think you're kind of disproving that. But so which is better, having like the bigger success and the more discomfort, or more comfort and less financial success?
Well, I'm really one of those people who literally cannot handle success. I mean, success as it is defined in the music business, you know, first of all, I mean, you're working all the time. You are working all the time. I mean, if people think that that's an easy job, they're crazy. It's impossible. I don't know how people like Britney Spears do it. I mean, I really don't. It is like a Herculean task, because you're never home and you are working 24 hours a day, and you know, and part of your work means to, you know, every person you meet, you sort of have to present this like you know, larger than life kind of charming mythological exterior of you know, star, you know, the star stuff. It's just crazy. I don't know how people do it. I really don't. It's just a, you know, you have no life. I mean, that's your life. And I think that if you have something in you that like is really you know, where the love of hundreds is not enough, you know, the love of thousands, it's got to be the love of millions, you know, like it's like there's never enough love, then that kind of helps you keep going. Or, you know, if you got stuff you're running away from, that helps you keep going. Or, you know, I mean, it's like being dysfunctional in a lot of ways really can help with that. But, you know, there's another certain kind of dysfunction that is just like makes it impossible. I mean, you know, I like playing shows, but it's a very controlled atmosphere. And there's always the assumption that people have come to see you are there because they really like you and like what you're doing. But, you know, I don't like people to look at me. I mean, I don't like to have my picture taken. I don't like to be looked at or you know, stared at on the street or followed or, you know, it's creepy. I mean, I just think it's weird and creepy. I don't know how people deal with it. So, you know, so there's that. But also, like, financially, in the major label system, you have to sell so many records to break even that you just don't make money.
And why is that?
And I'm making more money now than I ever have.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you don't have to pay back all the stuff to the record company.
Yeah.
What is paid for out of the money? I mean, why do you have to earn so much before you turn a profit?
Well, it's really, really complicated. It's, you know, you get a percentage. I mean, say you get 15%, but there's sort of a list of things in your contract that sort of exempt money from going into that pool of 15%. You know, they deduct for breakage and, you know, packaging, and there's all these things. So it really comes down to, like, I don't know, 7%. But out of that 7%, you have to pay back all the costs of the record. If the record cost, you know, I mean, records today, there's records that cost $500,000. You know, I don't make records like that, but you know, people do. So, you know, you pay back the cost of the record, but out of that 7%. And right. You pay back the cost of the video and tour support and all that. I mean, it just, you know, you can spend $1 million on a record, you know, or promoting a record or tour support. I mean, you can spend anything. You can spend giant amounts of money. But even if it's sort of a modest amount of money, it's you got to sell a lot of records to make that 7% add up to, you know, whatever the cost of the record is.
Has it been a problem or a welcome thing to have to handle some of the business end of your music now?
I just, it's, my attitude is that I just can't, I just could not keep doing that. And whatever, you know, I would just do whatever it took to get out of it. And, you know, so whatever I have to deal with now, at least it's, you know, I mean, there might be headaches now, but at least they're different headaches, you know, it's a new headache. So it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting and fun. It's, you know, it's not sort of, it's not impossible, you know. I mean, I might have small gains, you know, and celebrate the fact that I can get my record in the store. But, you know, but that's very satisfying, you know, or I might make mistakes, but at least I'm making the mistakes, you know. It's me who made the mistakes. And, you know, I'll suffer the consequences of my mistakes, but I don't have to suffer the consequences of other people's mistakes.
Did you enjoy your night at the Academy Awards? Even though you didn't win, Phil Collins won.
Well, it was surreal. I mean, it was bizarre. I don't know if I could say it was enjoyable because it, you know, you're working. I mean, I played, so for me, it's a working night, and just being at those kind of things, it's, you know, I feel like it's business oriented and it's working, and there's, you know, it's, you can't sort of really sit back and enjoy it in that way. So for me, an enjoyable experience is when everything goes smoothly and, you know, the monitors work and the guitar is in tune and you remember all the words, you know, like that's a fun time for me.
So that was good.
Yeah. I thought it was, you know, it was great. I mean, it was interesting. It was fascinating. I had no, you know, I knew that there was no way I was going to win. So I wasn't plagued with that kind of thing.
Did you have a little speech planned just in case?
No.
You were that confident?
No. Yeah, I mean, I sort of knew there's like a category of people that, you know, I mean, that I would have thanked, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, obviously, and sort of people at, you know, people at New Line and my manager and that kind of thing. But I mean, I didn't sort of have a speech around that.
Well, Amy Mann, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Amy Mann's new CD, Bachelor No. 2, is on her own label, Super Ego Records. Here's a song from it called Susan.
Someday he'll